Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Duke by Catherine Ash. Narrated by Mary Sarah. Come what might, she would be wild, untrammeled, free. James Joyce, Ulysses. Rule Britannia, rule the waves, Britons never will be slaves. James Thomson. Prologue. The Plan. April 1808. Willows Hall. Estate of the Earl of Vale. Shropshire, England. At the advanced age of 8, Lady Amarantha Vale announced to her elder sister, who was her closest companion, that she would not marry for wealth, title, or land. "For what will you marry, then?" Emily replied. "Love, of course," Amarantha declared, adding, "silly." But she did not blame her sister for obtuseness. Emily had been betrothed since birth, and had no choice in the matter. Obviously she hadn't given it any thought. Amarantha had. She had given it lots and lots of thought. Moreover, from the stories her father read to them about the great heroes of yore, she knew precisely which sort of man would steal her heart. "He will be frightfully strong and fearsomely brave," she said. "He will have blue eyes that sparkle like the sea, golden curls that shine like the sun, and shoulders so broad that he could carry a mountain upon them. To support all of that magnificence, he must also have legs like tree trunks," Emily said, turning the page of the book their father had lent her that morning. "Oh, yes," Amarantha said, knowing her sister teased. But she never minded teasing when it was done lovingly. "He will be gentle and kind, too, especially to small children and animals, and always chivalrous with ladies, and he will be generous. He will give away his riches to anybody who needs them." "That will be impractical. How will your family acquire food and shelter?" "With my dowry, of course. And when that is spent, I will take in sewing projects like Fanny Butterworth in the village does." "Sewing?" her sister said skeptically. "You don't even like to embroider."
"That doesn't matter," Amarantha said, blithely waving away the obstacle. "I will do whatever necessary so that we will be happy. Anyway, I will have some time to do those sorts of things when he is off leading his men to victories against the enemy.
The French, presumably.
And any other villain that crosses him. He will ride a magnificent white steed, which will gallop valiantly into battle, and he will enjoy making snowmen."
"A horse making snowmen will be a sight to see, for sure." Amarantha laughed, flopped onto her back, and stared at the crisscrossing branches above, which were dotted with new green leaves, unfurling from their winter's repose. It was springtime, and even the air sang of expectation.
"He will travel all over the world and get into all sorts of wonderful scrapes and adventures."
"Won't you accompany him on these adventures?"
"When I'm able, for I will have infants to care for. We will have 6 children, but he will definitely accompany me on my adventures."
"I think I am beginning to like this paragon."
"Good, because we will always prefer staying at home. So you must visit often, and our sisters too, and he will love his mother and father as much as I love mine."
"It sounds like a fine plan, Amy." Emily looked up from her book.
"But you know that Papa will choose a husband for you, as he will for our sisters as well." "I will ask him not to," Amarantha jumped up, scattering the grass braid she had fashioned with fingers full of energy. She stepped out from beneath the shading branches. Mama always said direct sunlight made her freckles even more numerous, but the warmth of the spring day felt so good, and she was simply bubbling over with anticipation. Her bridegroom wouldn't dislike a few freckles, after all. He would love her too much to care about that sort of thing. "I will choose him myself, and I will know him the moment I see him."
"How?"
"By his smile, and kind words, and good deeds."
"He sounds like a veritable Prince Charming."
"He will not be a prince," Amarantha said, stretching her arms out at her sides. The sun in her hair was like a wild dancing of flames. He will be an angel, my angel, and I will love him and no other with all of my heart until the day that I die. She twirled faster and faster on bare feet until the trees and grass and sunshine blurred. Part 1 1817 The Innocents Chapter 1 The Departure August 1817 Willows Hall, Shropshire.
Dearest daughter Emily, a companion has been hired. The ship has sailed. Your sister is gone. I am beside myself and have told your other sisters that if they ever so much as glance at a preacher, their father will disown them. How unfortunate that man resembles the man in her childhood plan! If only he had black hair and a dark countenance, our darling Amarantha would never have glanced twice at that unsuitable mister with his wretched mission. I would curse Golden Curls entirely if not for the delightful lemon wash Sally prepares for my toilette, which has superb effects on mine. Amarantha's suitors are deeply vexed. Upon hearing the news, Lady Witherspoon's poor Eustace wept into his tea and experienced such a disturbance of temper that he did not leave his room for 2 full days. Sir Roger announced his intention of sailing after her at once. Your father felt it necessary to remind him how last summer, at the punting party, he became ill from the rocking of his boat, which Sir Roger explained was due to taking 4 lemon custards that day rather than his usual 3. Lord Brill's poem, Destitution Upon the Loss of a Strawberry Flower, which I enclose here, speaks for itself. Yet I fear none of their manly tears will bring her home. I also enclose a message to you from your father. How devastated he is to have lost not only you to London, but also now our beloved Amarantha to the wretched colonies. I shall cry myself to sleep tonight and spend the entire se'nnight in bed with the draperies drawn, taking consolation only in the knowledge that Manchester is governor of that miserable island now, and his duchess is exceedingly stylish, despite now being a colonial. Our darling Amarantha simply must cling to her for guidance. Do come up to the hall soon. We are at quite a loss now, and a visit would cheer us. Cos bis, your devoted mamma. Enclosed.
Dear Emily, your mother is in high distress, as are your sisters, and indeed the entire household. When Mr. Garland sailed 2 months ago, I felt certain that, in his absence, Amarantha would swiftly come to her senses. Yet she remained steadfast. I am persuaded that the novelty of it all deserves some credit. She has always been my most dauntless daughter. I have little hope that Garland will make her truly happy. But I have every faith that our intrepid, big-hearted Amy will nevertheless wrest happiness from whatever adventure she throws herself into. With affection, Edward Papa, 7th Earl of Vale.
10 October, 1817, The Queen's Hotel, Kingston, Jamaica.
Dear Emmy, this is not at all as I anticipated, but I will try to describe it. The people seem English, yet how different from in Shropshire. Everywhere one sees great excess beside great want. Modestly prosperous gentlemen and gentlewomen wear monstrous loads of fashion, even as Mamma and Papa do. Yet I have seen others so poorly clothed that they lack shoes. The hotel manager says the latter are slaves and cut sugar cane in the fields. Without shoes? In fact, it seems that most people one encounters here are slaves. I remember now that you told me this would be so. But how remarkable to actually see it. Some of the sailors aboard our ship and servants at the hotel, however, are freed men. When I asked the chambermaid about this, she said that some freed men have shops and land, and that even the pastor of her church is a freed man. Despite your attempts and Papa's to teach me of the world, I had little notion of any of this before. How much I have now to learn. My companion, Mrs. Jennings, thinks the gentry here are puffed up like mushrooms.
She is nevertheless eager to visit with them. She adores gossip and is very silly. Several have already called on us here. The Duchess of Manchester sent an invitation to stay with her until the wedding, which I declined. My darling Paul says it would be unsuitable for the fiancé of a humble missionary to reside at the governor's mansion. As to the island, all is lush and verdant beyond imagining. The heat is astonishing. There are glorious mountains and beaches with the whitest sand I have ever seen. Here are fruits I did not know existed before 2 days ago. Guava, mango, pineapple, and breadfruit. They are all delicious. Mrs. Jennings dislikes them and demands marmalade. The port itself is astonishing. The bay is filled with every sort of vessel, and everywhere there are people speaking in so many tongues that one's head spins. The greatest sight is the Fairway. Her captain and crew are heroes of an important battle. I do not recall which. You know I am a wretched study at history. It is a spectacular sight. The Union Jack flying proudly from the mast of such a magnificent ship in the lapis waters of this world, so far from home. In truth, I never understood the vastness of our empire until now. All is not entirely alien. My darling Paul's church is blessedly quaint, although somewhat austere. He promises to make me known to the parishioners as soon as I have regained my bearings on land. I told him that I do not suffer from lingering sea legs, so he needn't have concern. It was adorable how he blushed then, and implored me to lower my voice. I believe the notion that I have legs gave him pleasurable pause. I do not shrink to tell you, sister, that it is thrilling to be admired by a man in such a manner. I am still astonished Papa allowed me to come here. He is the most generous, most kind, most wonderful father in the world. A footman has just told us that a storm will arrive tonight, but that we must not fret, although we are across the street from the quays, for the hotel is tightly corked. How singular of him to alert us to a storm, and how clever to know when it will happen. Beyond the window-pane, I see there is now great activity at the Dorks. Rather than put this letter in the hands of the footman, I will walk to post it myself. Mrs. Jennings says we must not venture forth without Reverend Garland's escort, but he has not yet come today, and I simply must escape this confinement, for by the time he finally does call, I will surely be in ill sorts. Also, I packed only one pair of boots. I should not like to cover them in mud when I walk to post this after the rain. With all of my love, Amy. P.S. The Battle of Rappahannock River. Chapter 2. The Storm. He saw her for the first time ever in a storage cellar with rain slashing at her face, standing atop a crate, struggling to fasten a window, and the first words he heard from her lips were, "Damn him, blasted to Hades!" Before he could duck his head beneath the lintel and move forward, she turned to him, eyes the colour of clover leaves and lit like lightning. "Don't gape, you big column of shark bait!" she shouted. "Help me!" A blast of wind struck the building and the shop above them shuddered. Her grip slipped over the window latch. Gabriel shoved his shoulders through the narrow doorway and in 3 strides crossed the room. The wind blew hot and punishingly hard through the opening, but she did not release the latch. Covering her hand with his, he drove the frame shut. The building moaned, and Gabriel found himself looking down upon a nose both freckled and wet, lips both lush and damp, lashes both long and dripping, and clover leaves that had gone entirely round. Her features were English, fine, and not unattractive. After 5 months at sea, he would have been one sailor in a million to resist following the trail of rainwater down her pale throat, in which her pulse beat visibly to the gown laced tight around her collar, sodden and clinging to her curves. Sweet curves. "Remove your hand from mine, and your eyes from where they have fallen out of your head," she said in such an altered tone that he barely heard it below the groaning of the walls and the pounding of the rain, rather the pounding of his pulse. Too long at sea. He removed his eyes and then his entire self. Stepping back, he offered his hand for her to scent from the crate. She lifted a single brow.
I beg your pardon,
he said roughly, withdrawing his hand once again. She grasped her sodden skirts and climbed nimbly down. You are pardoned. Shark bait. This time.
Lieutenant,
he corrected. Swiftly scanning the room with those eyes that even in the murky light of this day were like the green of Highland mountains, she untied the ribbons at her throat, removed her dripping bonnet, and tossed it atop a barrel. Have you got a handkerchief? He reached into his waistcoat and proffered the square of linen. She glanced at his outstretched hand, then at his face, then at his hand again, and did not move forward. You're a giant beast of a man, aren't you? She said.
So I've been told.
He set the linen on a crate and backed away, curling his fingers into his palm that had easily encompassed her whole hand. Taking up the kerchief, she unfolded it with trembling fingers and wiped the rainwater from her face. Wind and rain battered the building in frenzied fury, filling the tiny space with sound. I wonder how you go along aboard a ship. Her gaze passed up and down him anew. The crown of my head is barely to your chin, yet I found the quarters aboard our ship frightfully cramped. Unless naval ships are much more spacious, you must spend every day bent over.
Aye, but only the part of the day below decks.
The lush lips twitched. When she withdrew her gaze to look about the room, he felt the loss of that reluctant smile in his chest, like the loss of air. Nonsense. He was muddled with exhaustion from preparing the fairway for the storm. This storage room beneath the shop was minuscule, heavy with heat, and packed with sacks of rice and grain, barrels of sugar and ham, wooden parts for furniture, skeins of silk, boxes of nails and other tools, and even one small keg of gunpowder. She strode the circumference of it, rounding him, and then halting where she had begun. The wind blasted against the shop above, and she tilted her face upward to peer at the ceiling that hung an inch above his head. Biting her lips between her teeth, she drew a hard breath, and then looked at him again. "I suppose you have experience with storms of this sort," she said. "Not of this sort." But spots of pink sat upon each pale cheek now. She had tucked her hands into her soggy skirts to hide their quivering. She was making a valiant effort to conceal her distress, more valiant than many a sailor he'd known.
"'Twill blow over soon enough, lass."
"That was a lie," she said, a dart forming between her brows. "Why did you lie to me?"
"I didn't."
He bit back his retort, but his patience was frayed. There had been no sign of the Thea entering the harbour. Though he had stood in the downpour until the swells were rising so suddenly and steeply over the quay, he had finally been obliged to shelter here. And now this, a sharp-tongued English girl with the manners of a stevedore. Gabriel didn't care much for social niceties, but a man wasn't made first lieutenant of a ship of the line at 23 by failing to mind his tongue. Minding his behaviour was another matter entirely. He bent his head, and a stream of water cascaded from his hat brim. He glanced at her through the waterfall.
"Would you be fretting if I remove my hat?"
The cinnamon spots that trailed over the bridge of her nose and across her cheeks crinkled together to make one big cinnamon blotch. "Why on earth should I?" He set his hat upon a crate. Wrapping her arms about herself, she watched him closely. "Well," she said. Some of her hair had escaped the knot at the back of her head and clung wetly to her brow, just as the fabric of her gown clung to her hips and legs. Copper hair striated with gold, softly rounded hips, long legs. The damp pulse in his head was a snare drum. He knew men whose cravings for feminine flesh got the best of them when they finally came into port. He had never been one of those men. Women weren't to be enjoyed like a randy stallion taking a mare, rather with as much appreciation as a man savoured a tumbler of fine brandy, or a sublime piece of music, or a painting by an Italian master, a Michelangelo or Botticelli. Sweet curves. Her garments were fine, her speech cultivated, and she was old enough to know that her damp gown was not in the least modest at present.
The stallion was winning. "'Twill be some time before the storm passes," he said in too husky a voice. "'Tis miles wide."
The brilliant clover leaves popped round again.
"Miles?"
Beneath the freckles and agitated flush, her skin was smooth, cheeks, brow, hands.
She had not been in the islands long, and she was little more than a girl.
After nearly a decade at sea, Gabriel could barely remember boyhood.
"You've just arrived,"
he said. "2 days ago, on the Camelot." Gabriel knew it. As first officer on one of His Majesty's finest ships of the line, it was his responsibility to know the merchant vessels that docked at English ports.
"No one warned you of hurricanes?"
"No." She had remarkable features, mobile and bright and expressive. Should they have?
"'Twill be hours still, and it will leave a mighty mess of destruction."
"How many hours?"
"Not till morning."
With a long inhalation, she released her arms from about her chest. "Then we should make ourselves comfortable," she said with newly crisp decision, and swept him with another perusal, lingering ever so briefly on the medals pinned to his coat. "If you can. You are as wet as I, yet you look like a toy soldier, standing there so erect and unbending. I suppose sailors are accustomed to being soaked through, of course."
"If they're bad sailors, I..."
Pleasure flared in her eyes. "Now, make yourself useful and help me search these crates for a woolen shawl or blanket, for I am soaked through." She set to her task on the nearest crate, but the lid was nailed shut and her fingertips strained at the wood. He went to her side. Scent arose from her damp hair and skin. She smelled like a memory. He withdrew the knife from his coat and pried open the lid.
"It seems that you are useful after all," she said with a half-grin that abruptly turned something very sharp in his gut and made him want to tell her the truth, urgently. All truths. Truths about the hurricane and truths about the depths of the sea and the stars and the heavens and every one of the sins that made him a beast indeed.
"Lass, 'tis as likely as no that before this night is o'er, the sea will top the wharves and swallow this building."
"And we in it?"
"Aye."
"I see."
For a moment she said nothing. "After we find blankets, we should look for a deck of cards or a backgammon board in these crates. For if we are to die tonight, we had better enjoy our final hours on earth, hadn't we, shark bait?"
"Lieutenant."
He could not look away from her eyes. Black clouds without blotted the tropical sun, allowing only the most reluctant light into this room, yet her eyes sparkled.
"Backgammon."
She had the body of a siren and the innocence of a girl.
"You have a disliking for sailors, it seems," he said.
"The officers aboard the Camelot confined me to my quarters for the entire duration of the journey. They said it was not suitable for me to be a torp, but I think they simply did not want me to witness them drinking the day away, every day. More than likely they did not trust themselves with the pretty little siren wandering about." "I think you are trying not to smile, Sharkbait. Will you attempt to deny that sailors drink excessively?"
"No."
"So, you understand the reason for my dislike?"
"Because hard-working men are fond of spirits."
"Because they refuse to share their spirits with me."
They found blankets woven of soft wool and tins of biscuits. They had no lamp, which Gabriel said was for the better, and she accepted that without comment. As the storm lashed the shop above and water trickled through the seams of the window and darkness fell, they found a cask of new rum. She said that she had never tasted rum and asked if, being a Scot, he preferred whiskey. He replied that he did, but that any grog in a storm would do. She smiled so readily, as though her lips were more accustomed to smiling than not. Despite her obvious breeding, there was no maidenly modesty in her frankness. It was on the tip of his tongue to say that over both whiskey and rum, he already preferred her. She discovered sugar, which he added to the rum to make it more palatable for her, and she sipped warily. As the daylight waned and she explored the contents of crates and barrels, she darted glances at him, frequently. She spoke with ease, but she came no nearer to him than necessary. When the black night consumed every last wisp of light, she ceased speaking. As the hurricane shook the walls, Gabriel settled onto the ground with his back against a crate. Closing his eyes, he made himself picture the Thea, bobbing violently at anchor in some nearby port. Its decks flooded in foam, but its crew and officers tucked into some terrestrial haven. No time left for repentance. He had thought he and Jonah would have plenty of time. Sailors perished every day at sea, but somehow he had believed them untouchable.
"Invincible, Gabe. That's what the storytellers will say of us some day. Invincible."
In the heavy darkness, her scent came to him again, like home. Not the mossy grass of the mountains of Callan, nor the wild flowers that carpeted the hills of Hyknes. She smelled of woodland far, crisp and warm and rich. The room rattled, and he felt her settle silently at his side. "How did you come to be here in this cellar?" she said very quietly. She was close to his shoulder, closer than he had anticipated.
"I was watching for a ship. You?"
"I walked to Postoletta and got caught up with exploring. Everything here is so different and interesting. I was far from the hotel before I thought to turn around." She made a sound that might have been a sigh. "I failed to heed the warnings."
"Dinna fear, lass. 'Twill be morning before long."
"You are lying again, Shark Pete." Then he felt the pressure of her body against his arm, her shoulder leaning in. "But this time, I don't mind it." He did not move. He could not move. He wanted her bone and flesh pressing against his, so simply. Perhaps in these final hours that had come far too soon in his life, God was offering him mercy, a moment of innocent pleasure after all the moments of sinful pleasure he had seized. Something bumped against his leg. Then her finger slipped beneath his hand. Her clasp was unhesitating, her fingertips brushing across his palm, then pressing tight against his knuckles. Palm to palm with her, he strove to breathe, and his heartbeats flew at 12 knots. "You are lying to comfort me," she said, "so that I will not dwell on how we are about to die."
"Am I?"
Only thin wooden walls and ceiling separated them from death, and yet the touch of a girl's hand was all he cared for now. "You are," she whispered clearly and softly beneath the storm scream. "It seems that I will be obliged to reconsider my poor opinion of sailors. One sailor, at least." Blindly he turned his face to her. He was, in fact, a beast of a man. She was a little thing that he could crush with a single arm, and he knew he should not be holding her hand, not even in this circumstance. He bent his head closer.
"I."
She did not reply, and her hand remained snugly in his,
and the night raged on.
Chapter 3. The Aftermath. 12 October 1817. The Queen's Hotel, Kingston, Jamaica. "Dear Emmy, there has been a tremendous storm. A hurricane. Yet now the rain and wind have gone entirely and the sky is as gently still as on a Shropshire summer day. But the harbour still churns and all on land is in upheaval. Mrs. Jennings will not allow me to leave the hotel unless accompanied by my betrothed, who has not yet called, although he sent a note with a boy yesterday morning to assure himself of my safety. Instead, I will tell you of the plans for my wedding day, which, because of events, has had to be postponed."
"Order of command.
By order of the Lord High Admiral of the United Kingdom and Commander of the Atlantic Fleet, you are required to take command of the Thea, with all the rights and responsibilities attending, and to carry out, and to cause your crew to carry out any and all orders by superior officers.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?